tonight, then we're going to be, everybody's on this side, so we'll be a left-sided study tonight, and we're going to be in Job 6 and 7. So what we're doing tonight is we're going to hear Job's response to Eliphaz. Remember last week, Eliphaz's speech basically was, hey, based on my observations, based on my experience, this is the way God works. If bad things are happening to you, then you've been bad. You've been evil, and you're getting your recompense. That's what God does. So he says, I've traveled around. I've investigated. I've done all these things, and I've seen this. Now remember that verse I keep throwing up there, Job 42:7. God says, Eliphaz is wrong. But these are the comforters. And Job tonight is going to respond to Eliphaz. And I want to ask you some questions about people who have given you advice and tried to comfort you in the past. Anybody ever given you advice that you have literally in your mind said, blah, 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 blah? Anybody? Okay. Have people given you advice that you can tell they don't understand what you're really going through? Is it important for us to try to understand what people are going through when we give them advice? Why is that? Yeah, and what if it's, you know, what if it's something we've never been in before? Can we still give advice? We can, but what do we got to try to do before we give it?
Understand and relate.
Yeah, understand and relate. We got to try to understand where they're coming from. Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever been talking to somebody who's been giving you advice, and you're talking back to them, and you just see they got something to say? And the second you're done, they come out with it, and it doesn't relate in anything to what you just said. Y'all ever had that happen to you? And you know that reel is getting ready to play in their mind, and it's going to come through their mouth, and it has no relation whatsoever to what you just told them.
Sometimes it's all about what they've been through.
Yes. Exactly. And Teresa said sometimes it's about everything that they've been through rather than listening to what you've been through. That's exactly what happened with Eliphaz. Eliphaz is talking about all of his experience. You remember his nighttime vision, all of his observation, his investigation, and he's not listened to Job. Because remember, Job's already gone on a tirade, right? Job 3 was this is what's going on with me. Come on, you know, I don't understand this. And Job tonight is going to start realizing that he was impetuous with what he said, that he wasn't, he was just upset. But what we're going to learn tonight is the power of being a comforter and what you kind of have to do in order to comfort. And then the big lesson tonight is going to be about the power of words. Words can either build up or they can tear down. They don't do nothing, right? And we need to use our words to help people, not just play our pre-recorded tapes sometimes. And you know, sometimes you won't know what to say. There is nothing wrong with saying, I don't know how to help you. I'm going to pray for you. If there's anything else I can do, let me know. Because sometimes we don't. We can't get the grief. But we need to try and understand. So remember, Eliphaz has just finished speaking. And you got to think too, Eliphaz is talking and his other two friends over there, you know what they're doing while he's talking? Well, that, but they're doing this number. They're all nodding along because we're going to see next week that Bildad, the next one, he takes it even more simpler than Eliphaz did, but he's got the same lesson, just more direct and more blunt. It's really not a caring attitude. But Eliphaz has hit Job hard, right? Remember, he started out being kind of nice and he said, are you going to get mad at me now when I tell you the truth? You helped other people. Practice what you preach. So let's look at what Job responds. So we're going to break this up. Like I said, we're going to be in verses chapter 6 and 7. And so Eliphaz is there. He's finished his speech. The other two friends have been nodding along. Job has seen this. Now, when you're telling somebody this is all your fault, do we look them in the eye usually? No. Now, we're kind of looking at ourselves going, you know, Bildad and Eliphaz, oh, yeah, I got you, man. That's good. So I want you to understand what's going on. The three guys are sitting there. Job is still in his heart, believes, I have done nothing wrong. He doesn't say I'm not a sinner. What he says is there's no unconfessed sin in my life. Tonight he's going to say, God, if there's something that I don't even realize I'm doing that is a sin, bring that to my attention so I can confess that. So he's starting to realize, well, okay, maybe there's something I don't know. But these guys are just pointing the finger at him, so let's get rolling in chapter 6. So we'll break it down, verses 1 through 3 first. Then Job answered and said, Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it on the scales. For then it would be heavier than the sea of the sand, therefore my words have been rash. So here's the first thing Job says. They don't understand the heaviness of his suffering. He says, Oh, that my grief were fully weighed. That means if you would fully consider and weigh my calamity, lay it on the scales and think about what I've been through. So obviously in Eliphaz's approach, he has not given Job any consideration for the heaviness of his burden. He's just come in, boom, boom, boom. You know, God only does it this way, and therefore it's all your fault. Well, there's not a lot of comfort in that, is there? Even if it were true, was there comfort in it? Can we tell people the truth from God's word and still be comforting if they're doing? What are you going to tell somebody who is sinning? You've got a child, and they are committing sin, and you love them. Are you going to go beat it over their head? You speak the truth in love. That's what we try to do. And, you know, you can say it in such a way that is considerate. Look, I understand what you're going through, but it is wrong to drink. It's wrong. Let's say that some person comes up with a great idea. Hey, I'm going to go sell drugs to make money. Okay? We can tell them that's a really bad idea, right? And we can do that out of love. I'm sure there's better examples, but I couldn't think of one at the moment. But we can talk about that. So he says, Oh, if you would just fully weigh my suffering. If you carried the load that I'm carrying, look at verse 3, it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. But then in verse 3 at the end, he says, Therefore my words have been rash. He's starting to understand, you know, maybe I did speak too quickly. Maybe I was too rash in my pity party back in chapter 3. Then in verses 4 through 7, he says, Look, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray when it has grass, or does the ox low over its fodder? Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are loathsome food to me. And look, what he's saying is, I am so grieved, and you guys don't get the bitterness of my suffering. I mean, I've lost 10 kids. I've lost everything I have. My wife's over here telling me to go do things that I know I shouldn't do. She's the only one I got left. I have lost everything. You don't understand the burden I'm bearing. You don't understand how bitter it's making me. It's like I've been shot with a poison arrow. What happens when you get shot? The poison goes into your body and it spreads throughout the body. That's what he's saying. He says, these trials, look, they may be from God, but I don't understand. And here's what else is going on. Those friends are adding to his bitterness. They came to help, and they're just telling him stuff that's making him mad, that's making him think that he's worthless, making him think he's wrong. Right? Because he knows, again, and God ultimately says that he's right, that he has not done anything that caused this. And we know that's true because we read how it started. Job and his three friends didn't know that. So they didn't appreciate the bitterness. So we need, when we're talking to people, we need to understand how heavy their burden is. You can talk to somebody that says, Oh man, you know, I just lost my job today. Maybe they got $100,000 in the bank. Versus you talk to somebody that says, Oh man, I lost my job today, and they got 20 cents in the bank. Is that burden a little different for them? We need to understand what it's coming from. Oh, hey, my car's broken down. You know, some people call AAA. Some people don't have a way to fix the flat. They need help. We just need to understand who we're talking to. And everybody that goes through the, quote, same circumstances is not going through the same circumstances. There's no two people alike. No two burdens are alike. And then nor is the reaction of people. Can godly people, can people who are walking in God's light become bitter? Y'all agree? Yeah, we can. And we have that. Look, bitterness is a sin. But we can become bitter. And we become bitter when it just keeps on and on. There doesn't seem any relief. What else makes us bitter? What makes you bitter? Yep, continued disappointment. Yeah. What else? And you know, Job's prayed. He said that. And God's not taking this away from him. So is that helping? And then you got your friends come over and they're just adding to your misery. So he says, look, you don't understand my bitterness. You don't understand what it's doing to me. Then in verse 8, he says, the other thing, you don't understand how hopeless this is. He says, oh, that I might have my request that God grant me the thing I long for. What was the thing that he longed for in his speech? He wants to die.
Oh, yes.
He wants God to take his life. He says, oh, that I might have my request that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have comfort. Though in anguish I would exult, he will not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. So here he's going to keep going, though, talking about his hopelessness. What strength do I have that I should hope? He's talked about God. What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life? Why should I keep on living? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me, and is success driven from me? So look at what he's doing there. He's just saying, look, I don't have any strength. God's not responding, he thinks. And I can't fix this. Where else are you going to turn? If you believe that God's not responding and you can't fix it, what else are we going to do? Anybody got any ideas? There's no place to go, is there? And that's when hopelessness comes. Let me ask you this. Is God watching over Job while all this is going on?
Yes.
Now, we get so bitter, we get so heavy, we get so hopeless that we don't realize that sometimes. You know, that thing that I tell you guys a lot, faith over feelings. If you feel unloved by God, you need to understand you are loved by God. If you feel that God has abandoned you, you need to remember, I will never leave you nor forsake you. When you feel hopeless, you need to remember, blessed is he who has the hope of Jesus Christ returning. You need to remember all those verses that are meant to keep us established in hope and in faith and in trust. Because we have the same ability that Job had to get down in the dumps. We have the same ability to be hopeless. You know, it looks so black. It looks so bleak. I can't see a way out of this. I feel hemmed in. He's going to say that later. I feel like I'm trapped. I don't know how to get out. What do? You keep looking to God.
I think when you pray, you're waiting for an answer from God. And you're waiting, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. And at some point, you feel God's far away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, Gary likes Star Trek, so we'll pick on Star Trek. You know, Mr. Spock, the logical Vulcan, no emotion whatsoever, right? And God gave us emotions too, but he gave us emotions to exercise and use rightly. Emotions can get us in a place where we do not need to be, and Satan will stoke those emotions. We can talk about hate all we want to. Hate's one of the strongest emotions. And boy, Satan will stoke that one. But he'll stoke hopelessness and despair too. Because once you start going down this road of, hey, God's not answering my prayer, maybe God's answer was you need to wait a bit, right? But when you start going down this pathway of God's not answering my prayer, what's Satan do? How's he going to come in and help you at that point through some friends? What's he going to say to you? Yes, yes. How's he going to do that? He's going to say, well, you know why God's not listening to you, don't you? Because you're really not a child of his. He really doesn't love you. Did he really say that he was going to hear your prayers? It's the same thing he did to Eve. Did God really say this? And we have to be able to go, yes, he did. Get out.
He's even going to do the same thing he did to Job through his friends because
he'll
feel like there's something he did.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You call yourself a Christian and you did this. And how many times have you done this? This is what I get. How many times have you done this and you still think God's going to forgive you? You've done this 100 times. Is God going to forgive me 101 times? Yes. Do we feel like it? No. That's why we cannot let feelings run our lives. We have to be careful. Because they are so fickle, they change so quickly, and they're such a liar. You know, you need to, if you're having a feeling that, hey, I'm depressed, I feel hopeless, then God's Word is the one that will give you. I have to take a course on Christian counseling in the future. And I'm just dreading that because, you know, my view of counseling is, what does the Bible say? This is what the Word says. You want to do it or not? I got to learn the lesson that we're listening to tonight, and that is to be compassionate, understanding, understand the heaviness, understand the bitterness. But it really does come down to God's Word. Either you believe it or you don't. And if you believe it, then part of your mind's got to go, I'm not going to let these feelings take over. So Job, he says, look, you haven't understood me. You've not tried. You haven't really heard what I'm going to say. You don't understand how heavy the burden is. You don't understand my bitterness. You don't understand my hopelessness. And then I love the last part in verses 14 to 30. He's basically going to say, y'all are worthless as counselors. What did I say? Ineffectual? That was probably a better word. But worthless is pretty good too. So here's what he says in verse 14. And you'll see a couple of things that are italicized possibly in your Bible. To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friends. You see that? Even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. So even if I was doing something wrong, you should still be kind to me. My brothers have dealt deceitfully. So not only have they not been kind, he says, my brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the stream of the brook that will pass away, which are dark because of the ice, and into which the snow vanishes. When it is warm, they cease to flow. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. Their paths of their way turn aside. They go nowhere and perish. The caravans of Timaluk and the travelers of Sheba hope for them. They are disappointed because they were confident. They come there and are confused. For now, you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. So let's stop there. What do he say? What's he saying? He goes, you're like a brook that these travelers see. You're like a mirage. These travelers see you coming and they think, ooh, here come my friends. Here come my comforters. Here come the people who are going to be my friends. And when they get there, just like a mirage, there's no water. There's no substance. There's no anything. It's all just dry ground. You had nothing to bring to me when you came. Y'all see that? It says in verse 21. Well, verse 20. They were disappointed because they were confident. So they, you know, hey, we thought we were going to do some good. They come and they are confused. For now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. Did I ever say, bring something to me? or offer a bribe for me from your wealth, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the oppressors. I never said that. He says, you guys have come with all kinds of things that aren't right. You're not listening. So he makes two requests here. I think I got that on the next one. He says, I want you to do two things. I would love for you to do two things. I want you to teach me. So I want you to show me where I have sinned. Teach me where I have sinned. And the second one is even worse. I want you to look at me. This tells you what these guys have been doing. They wouldn't even look at him. They came, they gave, so far Eliphaz only, but Eliphaz gave his speech. You know, he's probably preparing that speech the whole time he's riding his camel, whatever he was riding. Whatever he's coming to get over to Job, he's got this speech prepared. It is, but now remember what their heart was. Remember what we know about these guys. These guys came, particularly Eliphaz, came from the center of worldly wisdom in Edom. So what's in his heart is worldly wisdom, observation and experience. So if observation and experience are the only thing in our heart, what's going to come out naturally? Observation and experience, which is wrong. But if that's the only thing in our heart, then from our heart, it's so are we. And here's the sad thing, that he believed this. And he may well have believed that he was being a comforter to Job by giving him his experience and his observations. They didn't do it in a kindly way, but maybe he just, you know, he said, I got a rough story to tell him. I'm going to tell him. But see, that's what God's telling us. We can't do that. Because what should be in our heart too? Should it just be our observations and our experience? No. Your word have I hidden in my heart that I might not sin against you. Right? So what should be in our heart that comes out of us is God's word. It has to be deep in there. Because when the trouble comes, the world comes first. The world's words come first. You know what I mean? We will react like we're human because we are. And it'll take us a second even to regroup and go, ooh, you know, I'm not supposed to do that. But that's a very good point. From our heart, what's in our heart? Okay, that's a good question to ask. So let's look at what he says in verse 24. He goes, teach me and I will hold my tongue. So instead of just lecturing me, teach me and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. And then here's something we got to learn. Remember, I told you we're going to learn about the power of words. How forceful are right words? How powerful are right words? You ever given somebody, just put an arm around them and said something to them, and it just relaxes them, it comforts them? Those were the right words. Those were the words that came from your heart. God used those. Those were powerful. Job says, but what does your arguing prove? Do you intend to rebuke my words and the speeches of a desperate one, which are as the wind? Yeah, you overwhelm the fatherless as you undermine your friend. You understand that? You overwhelm the fatherless as you undermine your friend. Who was their friend? He was. So all you're doing here is you're arguing and you're undermining your friend, me. I want you to teach me where I have sinned. I want you to show me where it is that I have erred. Now, isn't that a godly request? It's an awesome request. We ought to be willing to ask each other the toughest thing. Let me ask you this. Do you think it's easier to confess sin to God or to confess sin to man, to your friends? Gary says God. Y'all agree? Yeah. And you know, the Bible actually does talk about confessing our sin to friends. Now, they don't have the forgiveness. They don't have the power. They're not the ones that we confess it for absolution. Got to understand that. What we do is we confess it for understanding, for help. But I think it's much easier to confess to God, because you know God is a loving God, a unconditional loving God, and He's not going to say, slap your hand out there, you did it again. Now, I bet you we all have friends that if you said, I did this again, they would say, again? Really, dude? Something? They're going to do something like that. You mean you did this again? When will you ever learn? How about that one? Anybody ever heard that one? Okay.
You can say, you tell somebody something, and they'll say, you should have, and then they'll tell you, you shouldn't have.
Yep.
That's just the rest of people. Yep. They'll say, you should have, I done this, but then they'll tell you, you shouldn't have.
Yep. They do. Y'all had that experience? I mean, we all had that experience too. But, so what he's saying is, look, teach me. Show me. This is honest request. And we need to be open with each other. We ought to be able to say, hey, and I know this is hard. Hey, you hurt my feelings. How'd I hurt your feelings? Well, and you tell them. The idea is to restore the fellowship between us, right? This church should be based on fellowship. And if we're walking in the light, that fellowship and that unity will increase. And those little things, look, it doesn't take much to drive friction, right? We can have something little grating against us, and boy, it'll be a little thing, and we don't deal with it. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it's going to blow up. And you're like, what just happened? I don't know, with your kids or your spouse, you ever done it? You're like, they'll go back to something years ago. What? I don't even remember that. So we just need to be willing to ask this, and he does. And why is he asking that? Why does he have the strength of faith to ask that? Because it takes strength of faith to ask your friends, show me what I'm doing wrong. Because he knows that if God's going to use them, maybe he'll tell him through them what he's been missing. You know, our non-Christian friends can be great slaps in the face for us sometimes if we're not doing something. You know, they may say something simple like, you missed church again last night? Man, you're getting rough. Now, what they mean is, hey, you're becoming more like me. But that's not what God uses it for, is it? That's right. That's right. God used unbelievers all the time in the Bible to tell people things. I mean, King Nebuchadnezzar goes crazy, gets that lupine disease, comes back and confesses God and proclaims the God of heaven as the God of his country, of Babylon. But he wasn't a believer. You know, we don't know that Cyrus was either. But anyway, I go on. But he says, teach me. Then look in verse 28. And this is the sad part. Now, therefore, be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede that my righteousness still stands. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory? He goes, will you just look at me? You guys have been sitting here. I mean, I don't know if they hadn't been looking at him for a week. You know, who knows? They've been there a week. But he said, will y'all just look at me? I'm not going to lie to your face. Look me in the eyes. And let me tell you, my righteousness has not gone anywhere. I'm still the upright man that God said I was in chapter 1. So, now in chapter 7, as we move on, he really turns, it's hard to tell, and every one of his speeches, you got to figure out, is he talking to man or is he talking to God? But he starts, and he's talking to God. And he says in verse 1, is there not a time of hard service for man on the earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hired man? like a servant who eagerly desires the shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages. So I have been allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I rise and the night be ended? For I have had my fill of tossing till dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Who do you think that sounds like? You Wednesday nighters. Who's that sound like? Yes, the preacher. It sounds like Solomon, doesn't it? He's like, you know, it's all futile. It's all vanity, you know, my life. And he's getting ready to sound more like Solomon here in just a second. In verse 7, he goes, oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never see again good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As the clouds disappear and vanish away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him any more. So he's talking to God now, and he's talking about how futile he thinks life is. He's talking about how brief life is. And he's just trying to explain to God how he feels. And he's struggling to do that. Y'all ever pray about something? Y'all have a problem in your life when you're struggling to explain to God how you feel? Is that okay? Yes, it is. And you got to understand that. And Job, look, at one point, we're not there yet, but Job is going to literally challenge God. Come talk to me like we're in a court of law. You know what God does when he does that? He comes down to talk to him out of a whirlwind. But that's the last thing Job says. Job gets to that point in his frustration, his feeling of futility. We got 30 chapters to go before we get there. Okay? But it's okay to deal with hard questions. God may not answer you right away. He may have you in this period of not knowing and not answering. Hey, here's your yes for a reason. You know, when Daniel had a vision, he prayed to God immediately, right? God, I want to understand what this is. And God delayed answering his prayer for 21 days, right? Now, what did Daniel continue to do during those 21 days? Did he give up and did he get frustrated and did he get futile? But he continued to pray. And when he was praying, this is key, angel comes in and goes, hey, God answered your prayer the moment you prayed it. He sent me with the answer. I just got delayed by the prince of Persia. I had to get Michael to help me. So he said, God sent me with your answer. I'm sorry, dude, it's been 21 days. I've been hanging around Isaiah because dude has come out of my mouth twice today. But that, he said, it took me 21 days to get here. How was Daniel during those 21 days? He was fasting and praying. That's right. That's the kind of steadfastness we have to have when we're waiting on God. It is so hard to wait on God. We want the yes answer. We don't want a no answer if we're praying for something, right? No. So we want yes. Do we want a wait answer? No. So all we really want is that yes answer really, really quick so we can move on. And God sometimes says it's not going to work that way. There are things in my life where I've prayed and I just knew that they were right. They're based on Scripture. I had this worked out. And God delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. And then I realized that the problem wasn't somebody else. The problem was me. And if we hadn't had that delay, if I hadn't had that time to think and pray about it, maybe I would never realize that. Maybe I would have gone off and done something about the other person. Because your prayer, anybody ever pray, Lord, change him. Change her. Anybody ever done that? Yes. Has God ever said back to you, it's not him or her that needs to be changed, it's you? That's an ouch moment too, isn't it? But he does that. And sometimes it takes time for us to realize that, because that wall of pride's got to come down. So Job is struggling. He's really, really struggling. And we can understand why. So then he goes in verse 11. He changes his path a little bit. Here he says, look, based on all I've been through, I'm not going to hold back. I will speak in my anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. And he says, am I a sea or a sea serpent that you, capital Y, that's God, set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body? I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. Now that's getting incredibly, incredibly frustrated. Look at verse 17. What is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? You see the change that just happened? See, Job is going through this diatribe. He's doing this pity party, but God's starting to show him something. He says, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him? What does that mean? What did Job just say without maybe even realizing it?
Who's the creator?
Definitely that. But what did the Creator do? What is man that you would be mindful of him? Yeah. So what did Job has just confessed? I know you're mindful of me. Kind of in a backwards way. You see what he's doing? He goes, you know, I'm a man. My days are few. What is a man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you would visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? He says, you're paying attention to me. I get it. Have I sinned? Look at verse 20. Have I sinned? Oh, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? So now he's gone from asking his friends to teach him how he's sinned to asking God to show him how he's sinned. Very key change. If you ask God to show you how you have sinned, is he going to show you? Yes. He'll use unbelievers. He'll use anybody. He'll use his word, but he will show you. Turn over to Psalm 19 just a minute. Psalm 19, verse 12. This is David. David had kind of the same idea. Psalm 19, verse 12 says, who can understand his errors? This is David saying, who can understand everything that he does wrong? Cleanse me from secret faults. And that word there, secret sin, secret faults, doesn't mean things that are secret to God. That means things that are secret to me that I don't know. Okay? Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. What's a presumptuous sin? A sin of presumption. It's taking God for granted. And you know how we do that all the time? You know, I know that this is a sin, but I'm under grace. God's going to forgive me, so I'm going to do it anyway. God, I'm sorry, and I'm confessing. Hopefully y'all don't do that, but that's very common. It's the way we rationalize our continued sin. It's the way we rationalize continuing to do something that we know is wrong. And Paul wrote in the Gospels, you know, well, since grace is so great and God wants to give it to everybody, should we continue to sin? No, 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 may it never be, is what he said. And we don't sin that so that grace can be more abundant. When we realize that we are truly God's and how wonderful and awesome He is, our lives should change. You know, like we talked about this morning, our neighbor should be everybody now. Our hearts should be different. But David kept going. Look in verse 13. He said, "Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless, and I shall be innocent of great transgressions. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer." So understand what David is saying, and this is true. God, if there's something little, if there's something I don't even recognize in my life as being a sin, I want you to show me and cleanse me from it. If there's a presumption in my life that I am operating on that is not honoring to you, I want you to show me that so that these things don't have power over me. And he says, if you'll do those two things, if I can get to understand my secret or my hidden sin that I don't even recognize, if I can deal with the presumptuous sin, then I shall be blameless, and this last part, and be innocent of great transgression. You see, what happens when we don't look for sin, when we let presumption go, when we let the little sins go, when we let things that we rationalize go, we're going to have a study in the youth group on respectable sins. That's going to be awesome. Because there's a set of sins that people think, that's just human nature. You know what God calls it? Sin. And there's lots of things like that. That's just who I am. Okay? You know what God calls that? Sin. Okay? We need to realize and call it for what it is. So David realizes this. Job causes this. He says, back in verse 20, Job 7:20. He says, "How have I sinned?" But look in verse 21. This is, you know, we looked at this in our thematic study. This is Job teaching grace. And you start to see how his mind is working through this chapter. And it gets better as he goes. He's still frustrated. He's still angry. He still does not understand. But he goes, "Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be here." He says, "Why don't you pardon my sin?" Why would he ask God this? Yeah, but you went too far. Why is a manhole cover round? No. It does that, but why is a manhole cover round? Because the hole it covers is round. See? It's very... Okay, so if he's asking God, "Why won't you pardon my transgressions?" Who is he saying has the power to pardon transgressions? You get this? So he understands this about God. And look at the next part. "And take away my iniquity." Who has the power to take away Job's iniquity? God. So this is Job starting to understand and starting to preach to his friends the real God. You remember in Job 42:7, God says, "Your friends have spoken wrongly, but Job has spoken rightly about me." So we start seeing all this collection of stuff that Job says. Now, Job says it out of frustration, but we go back in chapter 7 earlier, he goes, "You're always watching me." You know, he's kind of mad about it a little bit because he's like, "You're watching me and you're letting all this happen." But the truth is in that statement, "You're always watching me." True or false? True. That should either comfort you or scare you to death. One of the two. For us as believers, it should comfort us. There is not a moment in our lives, not a second, where God is not watching us. Now, some people...
In verse
No, he's saying, I'm going to be dead. Look in verse, one line above that. For now I will lie down in the dust. He says, I'm going to die at some point. And you'll seek me about I'm not here. I won't be here anymore. He's going to talk about where he's going to be in 11 chapters. Okay? But he's like, I'm not going to be here because I'm so miserable, I'm going to die. But you see how he used to want to die? You see a little bit of movement here? So now he's going to God and he's saying, why won't you pardon me? Why won't you take away my iniquity? You've got the power to do it, he's acknowledging. So God has that power. So that's where we stop. Now let me ask you this. So he's given this speech. His friends have heard it. And you think that next week that they're going to give him kindly, loving words because of it? No, y'all know the story. But tonight, let's think about this. Job teaches us the power of words. Now, these guys, like we said last week, they used religious words. They used philosophical words. They used words that sounded good, but they were completely wrong. So we need to understand that words have power. Job longed for words of grace and peace, and they simply gave him philosophical words and religious words. So go over, as we close tonight, to Ephesians 4:29. This is Paul telling us what our words should be. And we need to always think about this when we talk to people. It's so easy to not do this. Ephesians 4:29 says, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Did Eliphaz's words impart grace to his hearer, to Job? They had nothing to do with grace. Okay. Were they corrupt? Now, we think corrupt means, you know, like cussing, something like that. It simply means unuseful, deadly words. Okay. So let nothing proceed out of your mouth that's going to hurt someone, but what is good for necessary edification. What does edification mean? Yeah, building up. So what is necessary to build people up, that it may impart grace. So what could Eliphaz, let's just think, we've got a long time to think about this, but you know, Eliphaz could have come in and say, Job, this is what the Lord has shown me. They didn't have the Bible back then. This is pre-Moses. Okay? I've heard this story about God giving grace, about God promising that we were going to have trouble in this world, but that he was going to send this Messiah, this descendant, this seed of a woman to give us grace and to deal with this sin problem. You need to have hope in him. There's grace. That story, Adam and Eve, was known, right? So there's ways that we can say things. We simply need to understand the power of words. You can cut somebody down with words just like you can cut them down with a chainsaw. And, you know, I can come in, if you and I worked at the same place every day, I could come in and tell you every day, Deborah, you're not looking good today. You feeling okay? By 7 days, Deborah will be sick. Statistical truth. I keep saying, oh man, you look worse. Did you try that remedy that I gave you? And it just keeps going on and on and on. And you keep saying it worse and worse every day. You can make someone physically ill. Now, why would we want to do that? We wouldn't. But we do that with our words to other people. We don't encourage them. We don't build them up. We tear them down. And who usually feels better when you tear somebody down? The speaker. And why is that? Yeah, did you say power? Yeah, power and control. That's right. Because we think, and you know, sometimes it's, well, I would never done that. You should have done that. You know, again, that's based. Yeah. It's the no-win recipe, isn't it? So that's just how we need to be. So we always need to think what our words are. So that's the big lesson for tonight is Job is simply saying, you guys have not helped me a bit. In fact, you've been kind of worthless. You've been ineffective. You don't even look at me. I would love it if you would teach me, if you would show me honestly where it is I would sin. God, I want you to show me where I've sinned. Remember, he made it to both people. First he asked them, then he asked God, show me where it is that I've sinned and I don't even know it. Because if that's possible, I'm like David, I want to confess it, that it doesn't have any power over me anymore. But they didn't do it. And then the don't look at me thing just bothers me. Can you imagine 7 days not looking at somebody? Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. Did y'all hear that back there? They're not only not looking at him physically, but they're not looking into his heart. They're not looking into what's going on in his life.
Sometimes if somebody will just speak to you, that's sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
When they add words to what they're saying, that's what carries
everything. Yeah, they start off good and come down from there. But Jennifer's right, because we got to look into their heart. We don't know. That's why it's dangerous to do what Eliphaz did. We're just presuming because of our vast worldly experience, that we know exactly what's going on with everybody. And we don't. Very true. And he's saying, look at me, and I don't know which one. I don't know if it probably is both. Look at me physically, because he was tough to look at, right? We know they looked at him when they first got there, but you ever seen anybody in a burn unit? Tough to look at, but what do they want? They want to be looked at, But emotionally, look into my life. Look at what's going on. Share with me. So next week, we're going to see Bildad get to the bottom, simplest way you can say it. And we're going to see the opportunity for God's grace to come in. So remember, words have power. The other lesson is don't worry about struggling when you talk to God. It's okay to struggle to understand. God wants you to come to Him when you do it, when you're struggling. Don't go to Dr. Phil, Dr. Oz, or whoever the current one is, but go to Him. All right?